Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland. Thanks so much for joining us. Tonight at 9 o'clock Central, SDPB-TV airs the third and final episode of the Frontline series, My Brother's Bomber. And it is a series which talks about the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland. And thinking of this brings back some memories for a couple of writers, and we have them joining us now. Dr. Patrick Hicks, who is a writer in residence at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, is here with me in the studio. Patrick, thanks for being here as always.
It's always a pleasure.
And joining us on the phone is Liz Prado. She is a writer based in Portland, Oregon. Liz, thanks so much for being with us today as well.
Thank you for having me.
And so let's start. I'm going to have Patrick start by talking a little bit about the Frontline series, My Brother's Bomber.
I suppose a tiny little backstory. On the 21st of December, 1988, a 747 named Clipper Maid of the Seas rumbled away from Heathrow Airport in London, and it banked north of Scotland. And roughly about half an hour after the plane took off, there was an explosion, and the plane came down on the sleepy village of Lockerbie, Scotland. And, of course, there was a great outpouring of grief, and there's a very powerful story about what happened immediately after the plane exploded and how the people of Lockerbie responded to what fell into their backyards that night. But this particular documentary by Ken Dornstein, which is airing on Frontline, called My Brother's Bomber, is really about Dornstein's search for justice, because nobody was really brought to trial for this, and it was all sort of murky, and we don't really know the story of who put the bomb on the plane and who detonated the bomb. And largely this is a crime that has gone unpunished from the judicial perspective.
Mm-hmm. And you have a personal connection to this.
I do. I remember quite clearly in 1988 when I found out on the evening news that the Pan Am 103 had exploded. I remember thinking, wow, that's so close to Christmas. You know, there were people on that plane that were flying home for Christmas. And so just from a human perspective, that was really powerful for me. But I didn't know at the time that one of my relatives who lives in Scotland, he actually works for mapping and zoning for Dumfries and Galloway Council at the time. It was his job, impossibly, to map where all of the debris fell. And that includes not just the parts of the plane, but where these souls came to rest on the ground. So I have this sort of insight into what that was like in the weeks and months after the plane exploded over Lockerbie.
And Liz, you also have a personal connection to this.
Yes, an old friend of mine who I went to high school with, Annie LaRoe, was one of the Syracuse University students who was on the arts program in London. And she had originally planned to be on that plane, but ended up planning to take a flight the next day instead, and most of her friends were on the plane. And I ran into her a week after the bombing, and kind of like Patrick, I just thought about it, wow, that's tragic, that's people coming home, but I didn't connect it with Annie in any way. And then I ran into her, and she was just so numb. She was a shell of a person. And so I have perspective into that, the grieving process and what it means. And I became obsessed with what does it mean to survive that kind of loss.
And so both of you as writers, this is something that has sat with you. Liz, I'll let you answer first. But this is something that you've had with you for a while and has just recently written about?
I was really haunted by it. Annie and I lost touch not long after the bombing, but that story stayed with me, and I would periodically find myself Googling about it, doing research on it, trying to figure out what was going on with the trial, trying to just understand the incident a little better. And it wasn't until 2008, I believe, that it finally occurred to me that I should probably just Google her and find her and ask her these questions myself, because I was just trying to imagine what that was like through fiction up until that point, but it was never really emotionally resonant. It always felt a little hollow.
And for you, Patrick?
Well, I didn't get an opportunity to do this, but my mother and my sister had the opportunity to walk around the debris field in Lockerbie about a year or two afterwards. And my relative would actually point to some of the more powerful stories about, we found so-and-so here, we found the large we found an engine in front of this railway station. The nose cone was found here. And it was very powerful, and he just kept talking about Lockerbie. We now realize he was probably suffering from PTSD, and who wouldn't at that point in time? Mm-hmm. So because he was so open with my family, in 2008, ironically the same year that Liz was talking about, it was the 20th anniversary. So I thought, well, maybe I could write an essay about it, and I called up my relative, and I said I'd like to fly over, and maybe we could walk the debris field, and I'd like to write something to honor the victims of this explosion. And he said, I can't talk about it anymore. So I decided to turn nonfiction into fiction because I couldn't get the story out of my head. So I set the story actually in my native Minnesota, and I had the plane take off from Minneapolis-St. Paul, and it explodes over Duluth.
Okay, and you want to read an excerpt from this?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's just a short paragraph. My main character's name is George McCourt. More than anything, George McCourt wanted to sanitize what fell from the sky that night. He wanted to restrain and muzzle the horror so that the families might be spared from just how awful the butchery really was. Let them imagine their loved ones asleep, slipping through the clouds like wingless angels. Pieces of husbands and wives and children had not been sprinkled over his city. There were no dents in the road where bodies had bounced up after their long fall. No, he would protect the living from such brutal knowledge. He promised God that he would do this. That's from my story, 57 Gatwick.
And you wrote that in 2008?
Yeah, it was one of those, and I'd be interested to see how Liz approached this as mm-hmm. well. The story, as I said, just kept gnawing at me, and it was one of those moments where I woke up at night, and I thought, it was like 3 a.m, and I thought, well, what if I made this fiction, and what if the plane left from Minneapolis? So I actually woke up at 3, sat down at the computer, and the first draft came out within maybe 3 hours.
How was it for you, Liz?
For me, I initially just wrote an article for Salon that was a nonfiction, you know, essay about Annie's experience, but like Patrick said, it still kept gnawing at me, and I realized this was something I needed to approach through fiction because I needed to get more at the aspects of the human heart. And so I originally thought I was going to write an entire novel from the perspective of a character similar to Annie, someone who had lost her friends at a very young age in this huge tragedy. And in the long run, I condensed it down to this story called A Proportional Response.
And do you have an excerpt that you would like to read?
Sure, I do, yeah. I still dream of my dead friends. I dream of them as they were when I last saw them in London. Young, fiery, bathed in arrogant wisdom. There were 35 Syracuse University students on the plane, and I knew 11 of them well. We'd all been in the fine arts program together. Our love is what happens when artistic souls recognize each other. We rushed together like twins separated at birth. Tori and I shared a flat in London, just like we had in Syracuse. Even though I was 3 inches taller than Tori, we wore each other's clothes. We wore each other's earrings. She was wearing a pair of mine when the plane went down. They were silver hoops. Nothing special. People at school always said they couldn't think of one of us without thinking of the other. I was grossly aware of this after the bombing, when I wandered around campus with everyone staring at my phantom limb. It did more than itch. It wept a thick black pus. That's it.
Wow. The images. So this documentary, this Frontline documentary, is airing, and the last one of the 3-part series airs tonight. And you both just kind of, how did the two of you connect on this topic, and what has this documentary done to kind of resurface some feelings? And I'll let Liz go ahead and answer first.
Yeah, well, we connected because when Al McGrahi was the only person who was convicted of the murders, was released from prison in 2009, it occurred to me, wow, I really need to write about this. And just in a Google search, I ran across Patrick's name and his story, 57 Gatwick, and so I contacted him. And so we have formed this really interesting friendship that came out of us both writing fictional accounts of the same tragedy from different characters' perspectives. And, you know, it really surprised me when I heard about the Frontline documentary because I had this feeling that no one else was still thinking about this. And of course, Ken Dornstein is still thinking about this, and he might never stop thinking about it. And I find it really fascinating that this is once again in the public's eye.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful it's in the public eye for many of the reasons that Liz has just echoed. And I was so pleased when Liz and I became friends, because it was really nice to know there was another writer out there that was grappling with these issues about wanting to write about a story and not being a part of it, but yet partly being a part of it. It was like mm-hmm. a strange water to sort of navigate. So I was really grateful to run across another writer and now a friend that, you know, was walking that territory, and I didn't realize it at the time. But as far as the PBS documentary is concerned, I mean, it's riveting and fascinating, and it makes me angry that these men were able to escape justice. And I think the greatest triumph of this this documentary is the simple fact that we are now talking about it. And it opens up the very uncomfortable reality that these awful international crimes can occur, and maybe justice cannot be met out. And one of the things that I really appreciate about Ken Dornstein is that he's just trying to get to the truth before living memory is wiped out entirely, because these are very old men now.
So we're seeing this documentary unfold, but then we're also hearing your words and your writings. And I'm wondering how the literary arts can help heal, perhaps, is that the right word, in a tragedy? And Patrick, I'll let you go first.
Well, that's a great question, and I've wrestled with this, because you know, I've written a novel about the Holocaust, and I seem to be drawn to these kind of wounds that are a part of people and stamped into their souls. And I think that there are certain things that happen to us as human beings that maybe we shouldn't heal from. And I suspect this is one of those things. I wish Mr. Dornstein great peace, but I have a feeling that he will never be at peace for this, as I wouldn't if one of my siblings was taken from me in such a violent way.
Mm-hmm. Liz?
Yeah, I have to echo that, too. I feel like there's this way in which any kind of art and literature gets at the human heart, and for me, dealing with loss, and profound loss for that matter, is something that's a part of my life as well, because I have lost my entire family. And I almost feel like my obsession with this, starting back in 1988, was something that was preparing me for that, and preparing me for how do we navigate the new world, because we don't get over loss, we don't move on from loss, we just become a different person, and the world becomes a different place to us. And that's not the popular narrative, I think, that we have out there. We have this narrative that, like, oh, you grieve for a year and you get over it. And I really want, through my writing, to make it clear that that's not how it really works, and that's okay. That's just part of being human.
And that's something that the readers can take from your writing?
I hope so.
That's the goal.
Yeah, I mean, I know that sounds kind of depressing in a way, mm-hmm. except that I do think that, you know, we're wandering, so many people are wandering around with profound grief, you know, more than a year or whatever after they were supposed to be over it, and they think there's something wrong with them. They think they're crazy, and they're not.
No, that's certainly the case. They're not. I mean, we carry this leaden weight. Even when we lose someone that we love and we know that they're old, you know, they've been taken from us, and we carry them with us in our heart and our memories. And I just, but if they're taken from us violently and swiftly and suddenly, I don't think that we're ever the same person again.
Yeah.
And is this documentary series, is this sparking more that you want to write about, Liz?
No. You know, it's interesting because in the New Yorker article that was written about this, Ken Dornstein said that he thinks maybe for now he's done with Lockerbie, but he suspects maybe he's not. But I do feel like maybe I'm done with Lockerbie. I think that I've told that part of the story I want to tell, and now when I go on to write about loss, I'm really going to base it more on my story and not so much on Annie's anymore or on the other people associated with that huge tragedy.
Okay. Patrick?
Yeah, I'm laughing because I thought that when I wrote 57 Gatwick, I thought that I had written all that I needed to write about, and yet, you know, yeah. This documentary has come up, and I wrote something for the Huffington Post, which I was asked to do, and so it seems like it keeps coming back, and I think that writers tend to write about very similar things, and I don't know why or how, but I suspect that my story, 57 Gatwick, it'll pop up occasionally. And I don't know why or how, but it'll be with me.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time and coming on Dakota Midday today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Patrick Hicks is a writer in residence at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, and Liz Prado is a Portland, Oregon-based writer whose short stories and essays have appeared in over 24 literary journals and magazines. And when we come back, we're going to hear about NOVA, examining the science and technology behind cyber warfare. You're listening to Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.